Okay, if you would open up to Genesis chapter 38. We're going to be in this chapter today. Lord willing, we should finish it with no problem. If you were here a couple weeks back, we went through Genesis 37. Genesis 37 is where we have that chapter of Joseph's coat of many colors and how his brothers hated him and how his brothers sold him into slavery. You know, they initially decide they're going to kill him. Then they decide they're going to just sell him into slavery, and they sell him into slavery. But before we read 38, if you would, look at the very last verse in chapter 37. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him, being Joseph, in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. Look at the first verse in chapter 39. Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. Do you see the continuity between chapter 37 and 39? It just really just seems to flow as one big narrative, as a Joseph narrative. But yet, we have chapter 38 just kind of plugged right here in the middle. You know, that kind of just kind of breaks apart the narrative of Joseph. And stuck here in chapter 38, we have the account of Judah, Tamar, and Perez. Stuck here, we have some fascinating facts about the lineage of Christ. And like all family genealogies, we have some things wish didn't happen, or at least the things that happened we at least wish they weren't in public knowledge. You know, we may even have a crazy uncle or a weird aunt. And if you don't have one, you may be the crazy uncle or the weird aunt, right? But you know, we all have these things that we wish we could kind of move past. And it doesn't take long to just realize that our roots are rotten. And so that's the title of this message, Rotten Roots. And what we'll see today is as the dirt is moved away, we'll notice rot, filth, improprieties, wickedness, sin. We read of Judah's relationship with his daughter-in-law, Tamar, which produces a child that the Messiah comes through. And to our surprise, the Messiah doesn't come through the obedience of Joseph. The Messiah comes through the rottenness and the failures of Judah. So we'll pick up, we'll read the first five verses of chapter 38. This will set the scene. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite, whose name was Harah. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son. And he called his name Er. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was in Chezeb when she bore him. Starts off right off the bat, it happened at that time. So what it seems to be saying is this happened around the time when Joseph's brothers had sold him into slavery. Because that's right where we left off in chapter 37. About the time that Joseph had been sold into slavery, Judah went down from his brothers. Judah seems to separate from his brothers. You know, even early on, I mean, they're one generation into this 12 tribes of Jacob. Early on, they were never really unified. The only thing they even seemed to be unified on was their hatred of Joseph. But in later on in the book of Judges, they nearly wipe out an entire tribe. So they never were unified. And we see here that Judah just breaks apart, breaks away, goes down from his brothers, and turns aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Harah. Adullam was one of the royal cities of Canaan. So this Adullamite, this man named Harah, becomes a close friend. Someone who Judah trusts. So Judah had removed himself from his family, relocates among the Canaanite people, and befriends a man named Harah. And in this passage, we'll notice everywhere hurrah is going to be mentioned, something bad's going to follow. So just quick plug, be careful who you surround yourself with, because the people that you surround yourself with are major influences on your life. And in Judah's case, this will be the cause of much heartache. So right here in the first five verses, we see at the outset of this chapter, we see Judah charting a different course than that of his fathers. You know, concerning his lifestyle, we notice the contrast. You know, in the last chapter, we see Joseph separating from his brothers by force. They drug him kicking and screaming and sold him into slavery, separated by force. Here, we see in this chapter, Judah separated from his brothers, but it's by his own sinful desires. He looks, he saw, he took what looks good, what feels good. Even concerning marriage, Judah's following a different path. He's following the path of Esau. Similar to Esau, Judah's going to marry a Canaanite woman. That's clear. It says here that Judah saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and then he has these three kids. But we need to be reminded, when I say he took a different path than that of his fathers, let's be reminded when Abraham sent his servant to go find a wife for Isaac, he said clearly in chapter 24, verse 3, he's talking to the servant, "You swear by the Lord, you swear by the God of heaven and the God of earth that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites." Under no circumstances was Isaac to marry a Canaanite. And Isaac is going to give his son, Jacob, similar instruction. Genesis chapter 28, verse 1. "You must not take a wife from the Canaanite women." This is not a racial issue. This has nothing to do with race. The reason they were told not to enter into marriage with the Canaanites was because the Canaanites served other gods. God's crystal clear on that in Deuteronomy 7. He tells them, you know, don't give your sons to their daughters. Don't take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. It had nothing to do with race. It had everything to do with faith. But however, we see, despite the example that was set before him, we see Judah ignoring that example. He marries a Canaanite woman. He marries a daughter of a man named Shua. And throughout this entire account, we're never given her name. She's just the daughter of Shua. Commentators suggest that the absence of her name implies she has no place among the people of faith. So we see, he sees her. He looks, he sees, he takes, he goes into her. He marries her, she becomes his wife, they have these three kids. And then it ends in verse 5, that Judah was in Chezeb when she bore him, when she bore these children. So Judah, the point is, Judah didn't just go marry this woman and bring her back home. He remained with them. He remained separate from his family, marries into a Canaanite family, lives among them at arm's length from his family. That's what we see. And now let's read 6 through 11. "And Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, 'Go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother.' But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground, so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, 'Remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up.' For he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in his father's house." So, verse 6, we see Judah taking a wife for Er, his firstborn son. Her name is Tamar. We're not told specifically, but it's generally assumed or generally understood that she was also a Canaanite. And we see in verse 7 that the firstborn, Judah's firstborn, this man named Er, was wicked in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord put him to death. We're not really told what his sins were or what his sin was, but they must have been awful. They must have been awful because throughout all of Genesis, throughout the entire account up to date, we have seen the Lord wipe out massive amounts of people at the flood in the days of Noah. We've seen the Lord destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. But this is the first time we see an individual being singled out and struck down by God. That should say something. This Er was wicked, and his brother Onan was cut from the same cloth. And we're going to read in verse 10 that Onan also was struck down by God. And we're told why Onan was struck down by God. We're told in verse 10, because what he did was evil inside the Lord. That's why he struck down. Well, what did he do? If you would, turn to Deuteronomy 25. Deuteronomy chapter 25. What we just read about, and we'll go back through it, but what we just read about is an early reference to what becomes known as a Levirate marriage. And it's interesting to know that this practice in chapter 38 of Genesis was in place before the law was written. Deuteronomy 25, start with verse 5. If brothers dwell together, like Er and Onan, and one of them dies and has no son, just like we read here, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as a wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. That's what we just read about. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate of the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He would not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak to him. And if he persists saying, I do not wish to take her, then his brother's wife, in this case Tamar, shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. Okay, you can read all about this occurring in the book of Ruth. This happens exactly like this. Ruth has a near kinsman who does not want her. And so Boaz, they kind of go through this whole exercise. You can read about it. It's only a 4-chapter book. It's a good read. Back in Genesis, that's what we saw the practice of happening here. Er had died because he was wicked. Judah goes to Onan, the next youngest brother, and tells him in verse 8, go into your brother's wife and raise up an offspring for your brother. What we just read. So what we see is Onan here going through the motions of this, but knowing the child would not be his. It's clear about that. Knowing the child would not be his, he would waste the semen on the ground. And look in verse 8. He's told to do this, and then it says what? In verse 9, but Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would do this. Whenever he would go into his brother's wife. Not when. When implies maybe once. Whenever. This implies it happened more than once. This affirms it was no accident. And we're told why he was doing this, why Onan was doing this. He was doing it so as not to give offspring to his brother. Scripture is clear about that. Well, why would he not want to give his brother offspring? Funny you should ask. As the firstborn, Er would have received a double portion. We're going to do some simple math. They had three sons. So with three sons, you would divide the inheritance four ways. In the oldest, the firstborn would receive a double portion. So in this case, he would receive two-fourths or one-half. Right? Heir would receive half of his father's inheritance. Owning would only receive 25%. But now with heir dead, there's only two of them. Divide it three ways, owning gets two-thirds. Owning just went from getting 25% to two-thirds. So here Onan is with two-thirds inheritance in verse 8. Judah tells him, go unto your brother's wife, perform the duty of your brother-in-law, and raise up an offspring for your brother. Onan knew the offspring wouldn't be his. The offspring would be considered heirs. And the entitlement of the claim of his father's inheritance. 50%. Right? So if Onan performs the duty of a brother-in-law, it's going to cost him financially. He just went from 25% to two-thirds, or 66%. He doesn't desire to go back to 25%. He doesn't love his brother that much, if at all. And it's kind of ironic. If you remember, it was Judah's idea to sell Joseph into slavery for money. Judah valued money over family. So is it any surprise that his sons feel the same way? But you know, Onan, he wants to give the impression that he desires to raise up an offspring for his deceased brother. He don't want to be shamed as the man who does not build up his brother's house that we read about in Deuteronomy 25. He don't want her to take the sandal off his foot and spit in his face and shame as the man who doesn't care to raise up an offspring for his brother. Onan has no desire to be shamed, but Onan also has no desire to raise up an offspring for his brother. Onan simply here uses Tamar for pleasure. And by him presenting the illusion that he's a great guy, you know, he's just trying to do the right thing for his brother, it leaves her with no alternative. The way this thing is going, she will be used basically as a sex slave until the day she dies, childless. She will be viewed as barren, unable to bear children. And he'll be viewed as a good guy with two-thirds inheritance. But verse 10 tells us what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. The Lord steps in verse 10. So he's then lost two sons. Judah has. So Judah tells Tamar here in verse 11 to remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up. A widow without children went back to her father's house. That's what they did. We can read this again in Ruth. Naomi instructs Ruth to go back to her father's house. Go back to your mother's house. So Judah sends Tamar back to her family under the pretense that Shelah was too young to marry. But really it seems as though Judah never intended on giving Tamar to his only remaining son, Shelah. Because you see at the end of that verse, for, but, he feared that he would die. Shelah would die, like his brothers. So Tamar went and she remained in her father's house. You know, she went, she was obedient to her father-in-law. But you see this basically almost like double speak. You notice what he says to her and then what he says to himself. He's saying to her, let my son grow up. He's saying to himself, really, I'm not going to risk losing my only surviving son. She thinks she's going to be given to Shelah. He thinks she's bad luck. She's a curse. And Judah, oddly enough, seems to pin the blame on Tamar. But Scripture couldn't be more clear. It was these sons that were wicked in the sight of the Lord. Their death was not at the hands of Tamar. Their death was at the hand of God. And it's just funny how living outside the will of God, marrying these Canaanite women, living among the Canaanites, it can kind of cloud your judgment. Living amongst the Canaanites, marrying a Canaanite, giving your son to a Canaanite woman, raising wicked son, yet it's Tamar's fault. It reminds me of Lot, you know, in the Sodom and Gomorrah episode. You know, just kind of living amongst that wickedness, and he just seemed to just became numb to it to a degree. Let's pick up. Let's read 12 through 19. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. Again, never gives her name. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shears, he and his friend Hurah the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law was going up to Timnah to shear the sheep," she took off her widow's garment and covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and she sat at the entrance of Enam, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, "Come, let me come in to you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" He answered, "I will send you a young goat from the flock." And she said, "If you give me a pledge until you send it." He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She replied, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went in to her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. Judah's nameless wife, this Canaanite woman, dies. And he's comforted, and it says he took his friend Hurah, and they go up to this feast. Remember, I said every time Hurah's around, something bad seems to happen. But here they go up to the feast. It doesn't necessarily say that here, but we do know from other scripture that every time they were shearing sheep, it was a time of feasting. We get this, you can read Amnon and Absalom, how, you know, in that case where Amnon had raped his sister and Absalom hated his brother for what he had done to his sister. It says, after 2 full years, during the time of sheep shearing, Absalom throws a feast. And he throws a feast and he invites the king and he invites his servants and he invites family. And that's where he murders Amnon. We can read about this in Abigail and Nabal. It tells in 1 Samuel 25, Nabal was a very rich man. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. David comes up to him. He asks for, you know, "We've been protecting your servants, if you would. We come on a feast day," is what he says. We're told in verse 36 that Nabal was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. So you see, they would feast during this time. Now, Nabal neglects to give David what he asked for. We're told in 1 Samuel 25, verse 11, Nabal says, "Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I've killed from my shears and give it to men who come from where I do not know where?" So you see, this time of sheep shearing was a time of feasting. There was a lot more involved than just the shearing of the sheep. And so Tamar here learns that she's not going to be given to Shelah in marriage. She saw she was not going to be given unto him. And when she saw that, she heard that Judah was going to be coming to Timnah. She's going to cover herself with a veil so as not to be identified, so he wouldn't be able to know who she was. And that works, by the way. And she posed as a prostitute. And the plan works. Judah does not recognize her, and he assumes she's a prostitute. He goes up to her in verse 16. He requests her services. And she replies, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" "I'll send you a goat. I'll send you a young goat." And the way he says, "I was sent," it doesn't really seem, now maybe I'm reading into this, but it doesn't seem that Judah went here for this purpose. He's not prepared. It's not like he had 10 shekels are in his pocket that he could offer. He seems unprepared, but he still desires her. And so he asks her, I'll send you a goat. And she, well, you're going to give me some collateral. You're going to give me a pledge. You've already promised. What she's thinking is, you've already promised your youngest son to me. You didn't give him to me. I don't know that I really want to count on this young goat coming. Give me something. So he asks, what do you want? What pledge shall I give you? And she's going to ask in verse 18 for some personal items. She's going to ask for items that she could use later on to identify him. She asks for his signet, or she asks for his staff. And the staff would be personalized in some way. She's going to ask for, She's going to ask basically for his signet and his cord. His signet was almost like a little cylinder-shaped thing that had his name or something that could identify him on it that he would use. And the cord was what held it around his neck, is what most commentators think. She wanted these two things, or these three things from him. The price is set, the collateral is paid, and Judah goes into her and she becomes pregnant. We read that. Then she's going to return in verse 19, back home. She's going to take off those garments dressed as a prostitute. She's going to put back on the garments of widowhood. We'll read verses 23-23. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite, Hurah, to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. And he asked the men of the place, where is the cult prostitute who is at Enam at the roadside? And they said, no cult prostitute has been here. So he returned to Judah and said, I have not found her. I've not found her. Also, the men of the place said, no cult prostitute's been here. And Judah replied, let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her. So Judah here leans on his trusted friend, Hurah, to go pay the prostitute this agreed-upon price, reclaim the collateral, reclaim the pledge, you know, reclaim my signet, my staff. Hurah goes there, can't find her. And the men of the city basically says, we ain't had a cult prostitute here. But it's different. It's actually a different word. When it says earlier that she dressed up as a prostitute, and then down here she's going to be a cult prostitute, it's a different word. So I'm not really sure why, and maybe Judah thought she was a cult prostitute. And so he sends his trusted friend, go back up there and pay that cult prostitute what I owe her. Here's this young goat. Get back my stuff. They can't find her. Later on, we're going to see at the end of this that he says, all right, just quit looking for her. Quit, you know, lest we be laughed at. You see, I tried to pay her. You see, I sent this young goat. Let's read 24 through 26. About 3 months later. 3 months later, Judah was told, tomorrow your daughter-in-law has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality. And Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. As she is being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, by the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant. And she said, please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. Then Judah identified them and said, she's more righteous than I, and since I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not know her again. After 3 months, this pregnancy would have been obvious. And he's informed, you know, your daughter-in-law Tamar is pregnant, and she's pregnant through immorality. He demands, bring her out. Let her be burned. You know, as she's being brought out, she's going to identify the man who caused this. And she uses these items Judah gave her as a pledge to condemn him. He identifies these items as his own, and he publicly confesses the sin. But it's funny how his anger is quickly replaced by a sense of guilt. I could only think of David in this case. David in 2 Samuel 12. You'll be familiar with this passage. David had went and took Uriah's wife and lay with her. She became pregnant. He tried to, you know, cover that up by making her lay with her husband. Uriah refuses to do so, so then he has Uriah killed. So in verse 12 of 2 Samuel, Nathan comes to David and tells him a parable. Two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he bought. So he brought it up, and it grew up with him and his children, and used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his arms, and it was like a daughter to him. See, this poor man loved this little ewe lamb. Then there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his many or one of his own flocks or herd to prepare for the guest who had come. But he took the poor man's lamb to prepare for the man who had come to him. Then David's anger was greatly kindled against the man, and he said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, and as the man who's done this deserves to die, for he shall not restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing, but because he had no pity. This man deserves to die." Nathan quickly says, "David, you're the man." I see the same thing here as Judah. Bring her out. Let her be burned. Judah, you're the cause of this. And his anger quickly subsides. Now, I'm not casting stones at Judah. You know, we all struggle with hypocrisy. But if it's wrong when they do it, or it's wrong when someone else does it, it's wrong when you do it. You know, and what I think we see here is a double standard. A double standard is really at the heart of this issue. Cultural norms had a different standard for men than it had for women. And even today, these double standards still permeate our society. You know, we do. We tend to look at sexual purity different between men and women. If boys behave in such a way, it's okay. You know, but if girls do likewise, she's called horrible names. But according to God's Word, when it comes to sexual purity, there is no double standard. And I think that's what we see here. Verse 27 through 30. When the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. When she was in labor, one put out a hand. And the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, "This one come out first." But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out. And she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." Therefore, his name was called Perez. And afterward, his brother came out with a scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. You know, we read here about the birth of what ends up being twins, Perez and Zerah. And it makes you wonder, just a random fact. Just a random fact thrown into the story of Moses. No. We read in Matthew 1, we actually went over this last week, so y'all should have this memorized. Matthew 1, verses 2 and 3. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of Judah. We just read about that. And his brothers. And Judah was the father of Perez by Tamar. So you see, this sinful union. The Messiah came through this sinful union. Through Tamar, through Perez. Rotten roots. And as I read this chapter, chapter 38, and the chapter surrounding it, which had in the context of the story or the narrative of Joseph, I looked at Judah and I thought, man, how could you be such a bad guy? You know, when your brother is such a good guy. I even looked at myself and asked, why are you not more like Joseph? Why do I identify more with Judah? You know, your initial response is a contrast between good and bad. But good by whose standard? By God's standard? You know, this is how I knew when I read in this that mentally I had a disconnect. I had something I knew, bear with me as I try to build this. We know mentally that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We know that. We know that all are sinners. None are deserving of God's grace. That's why it's called grace. Well, let's look at David. David sins with Bathsheba. That's what sinners do. David's sins, as sinners do, and as horrible as they were, what he did with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. David also has many acts of godliness. His compassion with Mephibosheth, his courage with Goliath. We know those acts. Therefore, when we read Jesus came through the line of David, we say, oh, well, that makes sense. That makes sense. But then we read of Judah in verse 38, in chapter 38. He's a bad son. He's a bad brother. He's a bad father and a bad father-in-law. Then we read that Jesus came through the line of Judah. We're puzzled. Why are we puzzled? Whose standard? You know, do we really think somehow David deserved it? David didn't deserve to be in the lineage of Jesus any more than Judah. But we overlook David's sin because of his good. But God can't do that. And so I couldn't help but just think on this chapter more and more. If you were an Israelite, say you're from the tribe of Judah, would you tell this story with pride? I mean, would you speak of your roots with pride? You know, my grandfather slept with my aunt. No, he didn't know it was her. He didn't know it. He thought she was a cult prostitute. You know, and once they found out she was pregnant, you know, they were going to burn her. Turns out it was his, so everything's okay now. I mean, would you tell that story with any sense of pride? You know, we all have rotten roots that we would like to forget. Like this. Do you know your roots? I do. Your great, 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 bear with me on the greats, great, great grandfather Adam was in paradise. He had one rule. Do not eat of the fruit of that tree. You can eat any other fruit of any other tree, but do not eat the fruit of that tree. He disobeys and he plunges mankind into sin and death. All mankind inherits the sin nature through Adam. And so if God had chosen to come through Joseph, he still would have had rotten roots. You know, that's what I had to get home. This rottenness runs all the way back to Adam. That's why the virgin birth was necessary. That's why we must be born again. Jesus came as a true and better Adam, and we have been purchased and adopted through His blood, and this rottenness, this sin nature, this checkered life that separates us from God, all this was paid for at the cross. Whoever believes in Him will have eternal life. So when you think about your family tree, if it runs through Adam, your roots are rotten and your spirits are dead. If your family tree runs through Jesus, you have eternal life. Maybe this chapter 38 is here to remind us in the midst of all this, Joseph isn't the hero. Joseph is a willing, willful tool in the hands of an all-powerful God, but God is the hero. So, in that, we'll close. Would please stand.